Let's turn to the RHI inquiry again. By the way, when I grow up, I want to be Sir Patrick Coughlan. I know that for the vast majority of you who are normal, you'll maybe think, what are you? Am I talking about when I'm asking you to watch the RHI inquiry? First of all, it's really important that if you're involved in politics in Northern Ireland, it's one of the biggest political stories there's been in a long time. Maybe you should go online and watch the inquiry or look at the BBC News website and where you'll get a broader feel for all of the different stories and information that's coming out. But the chair of the inquiry, Sir Patrick Coughlan, and I've no doubt he would be no fan of mine, but I'm fascinated by him. I really, really am. Have a look at it and see what you think. Anyway, back to today's story. Enough about what I think. More very significant information from the RHI inquiry yesterday as Arlene Foster's former special advisor, Andrew Crawford, continued to give evidence. Mr. Crawford publicly apologised for sending a confidential government document about the RHI scheme to a relative during questions. Dr. Crawford insisted his action, one of three times when he sent confidential RHI material to relatives, had not given his poultry farmer cousin an advantage.
Maybe if you give me a couple of minutes, I'll just set out what is the best of my knowledge. In terms of when I piece it together, Richard, as you've said, has six poultry houses. And I believe there's a biomass boiler now in each of those six poultry houses. At the time of sending this email, Richard had two poultry houses up a number of years and had recently constructed a third poultry house. The original two poultry houses, according to his witness statement, were powered by gas. The third, he was putting in a hot water heating system. However, it was run by gas rather than biomass boilers. Even though the biomass or the RHI scheme was in place when he constructed the third house. Now, to the best of my knowledge, and I suspect I had a discussion with Richard lives beside Clougham Livestock Market. There's a very good canteen at the market. I would have been there that day, I believe, selling cattle for my father. So when I trace it back, I can see that cattle were sold that day or livestock were sold in the market that day. And I suspect I met Richard in the market that day. And I was talking to him about his new poultry house that he'd recently constructed. And I suspect the debate came up about why he didn't put in a biomass boiler into that poultry house and why he powered it with gas instead of biomass when the scheme was up and going. And bearing in mind at this time the scheme was being undersubscribed and we're encouraging more people into the scheme. I don't recall a detailed discussion on it. However, I suspect what Richard asked for that at that stage was had I any information about the biomass scheme, and hence I sent him through the consultation document. I shouldn't have sent it through to him. I want to apologise for it. It was wrong. It was wrong on my behalf. I put that into my second statement, but I want to put that on the record here today. However, there was nothing in terms, it was not sent, the document was not sent to Richard for comments in relation to what was not consultation document, or was it sent to him looking for proposed changes to that consultation document. And I think if we go on to look at what changes were made to the consultation document, they were very specific. They related to tallow. That is very specific to the rendering industry in Northern Ireland. And the changes made to that document in no way could have advantaged Richard and his business interests. In terms of, if we go back to Richard's statement, he did not act. He did install biomass boilers into his poultry unit, but that was 12 months after he received this document. I believe it was around that period. And in terms of the advantage that Richard would have of receiving this document, he was only receiving the document a number of weeks before the document was in the public domain. So it's not a matter that, you know, he had a number of weeks to get into a scheme or not get into it. It was a matter that this was a consultation document that was going up in the public domain, and he seen it a few weeks in advance of that. It was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. But in no way did Richard in any way advantage through this, nor did he give me any information in terms of change in policy or setting policy direction or moving in a different direction, having a policy implemented in a different direction.
So that's some of the evidence from the inquiry yesterday. The newsletter, Sam McBride, joining us again. Sam's keeping across all the detail of this. Sam, we hear this a number of times from different people in the inquiry. It was wrong, I shouldn't have done it, which leads to an obvious question from the public, I guess. Why did you do it?
His explanation for that yesterday, as you heard there, and he went on to give some further detail about it, was effectively he said at one point that it was almost laziness on his part, that he really, with hindsight, ought to have pointed his cousin towards a website or could have been in touch with officials or something like that, where he could have asked questions about how to install these things if he wanted to do it. But what he actually did was pass this, and just for context, this was a confidential government document. It was something which was to be published publicly 16 days after he sent it to his cousin. But at this point, it was confidential. It was within the government system. It hadn't been cleared by the minister. It hadn't been cleared even by Andrew Crawford, the special advisor. And one aspect of this document was that it contained the information that a method of cost control is to be introduced that will ensure budgets are not overspent. It made clear that the budget was finite for new installations and there were budget limits which cannot be breached. So it was a document which had potential significance to somebody who was thinking of getting into the scheme. But as you heard there, Dr. Crawford was very clear in his evidence. He said my cousin didn't act on this in a way that advantaged him. But I think it's clear there was at least the potential for him to be advantaged by being passed a confidential document, which was not available to the man or woman in the street in Northern Ireland at that point.
I think the bigger question, Sam, for people listening to the programme this morning, it might not be about that individual incident and what happened, and let's let the inquiry decide the significance of that. It is more about a culture, is it not? About are we getting an insight into a culture where here you have we know that some of the officials were getting information wrong and passing that up the chain to Arlene Foster as a minister, and the information was wrong. We know that the special advisor, Dr. Crawford, didn't read 100 grand reports that cost us, the taxpayer, 100 grand. And we now know that something that's confidential, he's sending out when he shouldn't. And he says, yes, that's wrong. It's about a culture, this. We're getting an insight into what happened in Stormont.
Well, based on the evidence which we've heard from officials and from people from the political side of Stormont, certainly government doesn't come out of this inquiry in a good light. Dr. Crawford was asked in considerable detail as to whether he'd ever done this before, whether there was a culture of passing out confidential government information, whether other DUP special advisors did this, whether he had done it. He said he did not have any recollection of doing it, but he did not believe that he had sent any other communications out. Now, Joseph Aiken, one of the barristers who was questioning him yesterday, he said, but you understand, you didn't remember any of these. And that relates back to something whereby last year the inquiry asked him whether there was anything which he had done in terms of passing out information which could be perceived as a conflict of interest. He had come back and said no. And it was only after the inquiry managed to find this email from his cousin that he then said, well, actually, yes, I did. Now, his explanation for that is that this was something which he didn't remember, and the email correspondence was contained within his government account, which he didn't have access to. But the barrister was really pressing him and saying, if you didn't remember this the first time we asked you about it, how can you be sure that you didn't do this on other occasions?
So just for me to understand that, Sam. So you have this huge scandal, this huge RHI scandal, right? And Dr. Crawford, for a period of that scandal, was in the middle of it. Okay, he had to stand down in his role as special advisor, and he is telling the inquiry, because people were asking and speculating about what had he told his relatives, what had he not, and he is telling that he told the inquiry that he simply didn't remember sending an email to his cousin. That's what he's saying, is it?
That's right. And he was asked a set of questions which are sent to pretty much every witness that comes before the inquiry. And one of those was asking whether he was aware of anyone, including himself, who had breached relevant standards, including but not limited to, by means of making premature or unauthorised disclosures, or had acted in any way where they had a real or a perceived conflict of interest. gave a very terse response to that in writing. He said, I am not aware of any instances. It was then, as I've said, after this email came to light through his cousin, that he then said, well, actually, I do remember this. And now, of course, he has told the story about being in the livestock market, etc., and what he thinks happened. But he says he doesn't clearly recollect what went on.
So if the inquiry is this, am I right in saying that if the inquiry had not have discovered this email by other means, they would still be taking at face value the statement from Dr. Crawford that this had never happened, whereas in reality it had?
I think that's a fair view of this. This is something which when he was asked about this, I mean, I think one caveat to that is that if this was, I'm not certain as to whether his government email account would have contained this, because he had obviously left the department. I'm not sure whether that email account was decommissioned at that point or whether it would still have been there. If it was still there, it would have presumably come from the department. It may be, though, that email account was cleared out when he left, that it no longer existed. I'm not certain of that, but certainly there's a question mark as to whether it would ever have come out if it had not been captured at the other end of the correspondence at his cousin's end.
Let me read this to you, Sam, and read this to the public listening to this programme this morning as well. So the Inquiry Counsel, Joseph Aiken, asked Dr. Crawford the following. Were you in the habit, and I want you to be very careful and think through what I'm asking you before you answer it, of sending material that you received in the course of your role as special advisor to people outside, whether that be family, friends, anyone else, but outside of the government service? And Dr. Crawford responds, no, I wasn't. However, in the nature of my role, I would have had discussions with various interest groups in particular policy areas, so I'm not saying that in a particular subject area that I wouldn't be speaking to various lobby groups. Was I in the habit of leaking consultation documents? No, I wasn't. I suspect because it was my cousin, my guard was down. So just the end of that particular contribution, Sam. I guess what the inquiry will need to determine, and we shouldn't, but the entire inquiry will need to determine, when Dr. Crawford says, I suspect because it was my cousin, my guard was down, some people might think, because it's your cousin, your guard is up even more.
Well, I think with that hindsight from the evidence that Dr. Crawford gave yesterday, he accepts that. I mean, he was very clear on several occasions in saying this was completely wrong. There was no sense, as there has been from some witnesses, that they are defending what happened in many of the instances here. He was very clear that now that he has this put in front of him, he says it was completely indefensible, and it's not something. And I should also make clear that he was asked whether Arlene Foster knew about this. Arlene Foster obviously was his boss at the time. He says he's pretty sure that she didn't know about this. But again, we heard a phrase which has come up many, many times in this. He can't recollect really with precision as to what went on at that period. But he's pretty sure she did not know about this. And if she had known about this, he says she would not have been happy about it.
Well, it'll be interesting if we find out from the inquiry when Arlene Foster did become aware of this. Like, when did she find out? Did she find out about this yesterday when Dr. Crawford was talking about it, or did she know about it before now? Well, let's see if we get any clarification on that. Arlene Foster, there has been some criticism of Arlene Foster, but actually, Sam, if we look at this yesterday, and the inquiry barrister Joseph Aiken told yesterday's hearing that there was nothing suspicious or dubious about Arlene Foster's letter to the banks at the start of the scheme, which urged them to lend to RHI claimants. Let's just actually hear what the barrister had to say.
This was a subject that had garnered a lot of media attention. I walked through all of those documents. The documents have been published. Is there anything else you want to say, or are you happy that I've covered the subject in fairness to you and the minister?
The one other thing I would put into it is the backdrop of the financial crisis at that, or just before that time. You know, so the financial institutions were probably tightening the amount of money they were lending to various sectors in Northern Ireland. So it was in that backdrop that the minister wanted the letter sent to.
And the letter, just to be clear, as I indicated, wasn't just related to RHI. It covered schemes.
Yes, it was
I presume, just to put it formally on the record, there was nothing suspicious or dubious about the letter. It was a natural course of the working out of these exchanges that were taking place in September. The letter was drafted by officials. It wasn't altered by you or by the minister. It was simply issued providing the information that had been prepared by officials to be sent.
That's correct. There's a very clear audit trail. There was a discussion at the overarching group to do with energy. The minister said she would write at the appropriate time. A draft came up to the minister. The minister signed off that draft without making any amendments, and that draft was then issued to the financial institutions.
Sam?
Well, I think that this adds a lot more light to a letter which came out in December 2016 at the height of the scandal. We know a lot more about the context of what was going on at that point than we did when that letter first emerged. I think there's particular weight to what Joseph Aitken, the barrister, said there, because it comes from somebody who has seen a lot more of the evidence than any of us. The inquiry has more than a million pages of documentation. He's been through a lot of that. And in that degree, I suppose, there is some good news in this for Arlene Foster. He is making clear that from what he has seen, there's nothing improper in that letter to the banks. And that letter, just for context again, was something which was really a cast iron guarantee from the minister, from her department, to the banks that you can basically lend to these people who want to put in these biomass boilers because we are guaranteeing that we will not alter their tariffs. And there was a sense in some of the evidence from people that banks and some other people were looking at this scheme and saying, it's just too good to be true. There's no way you can possibly be getting that for 20 years. And this was a letter from the department saying, you can lend to these people because this is what we're doing.
From Arlene Foster.
From Arlene Foster. What you heard there is that this was something which was instigated really by officials. They drafted it. She didn't have any massive involvement in it, albeit it still went out in her name. It was her name on it. It was a guarantee in her name, but it was on behalf of the department rather than something that she was particularly pushing or that her SPAD was getting terribly involved in at that point.
Just finally, Sam, at the start of yesterday's evidence, I noticed the inquiry chair, Sir Patrick Coughlan, giving advice to the public on how they should follow the inquiry. Let's have a listen.
I'm not criticising the press or the media, but I'm just saying to the public, if you think something sensational is being said, go to look at what the evidence was. Don't prejudge what a witness is going to be asked about or is going to say until that witness has finished his or her tranche of evidence.
Yes.
That's the only fair way to do it.
Yes, and I'm sure Dr. Crawford will be grateful for that further indication from the inquiry because obviously it's a difficult process giving evidence to the inquiry and being the subject of comment the inquiry.
Yeah, many people the subject of comment, but the evidence is the evidence. We are a factual inquiry.
Yes.
Through the chair, I appreciate the comments this morning. Very much I see, I appreciate the inquiry and it's impartial and you're looking at the evidence and that's what you have to do. And I want to provide as the best I can and the information I can to help you in that process. Now, I do feel that in some of the media and how it's been handled, they've been selective in what they report.
Now, Dr. Crawford, I'm not inviting a comment from you. Thank you.
That's okay, thank you.
He takes no nonsense, Sam, does he?
Certainly robust at points. I think that comment from Sir Patrick, I suppose, is part of a wider thread running through this inquiry. He's been very consistent in saying this is a public process. He emphasised that they are streaming this live on the website. They're putting the transcripts up. They're actually putting an awful lot of the documentation up, thousands of pages. So he's emphasising, I suppose, there to the public, if you hear something, you're hearing a little snippet of the evidence. It's a bit like following a court case through reports in the media. Unlike a court case where you can't follow that online, he's saying to people, you can actually go watch this yourself. You can see it in context day after day. There's nothing hidden about this. And I think that is a strength of this process, that people who would be suspicious of some of these processes say that government can cover up or anything of that nature. This is being done in public, in the glare of publicity, not just to you and me, but to everyone who cares to watch this online.
Yeah, and I think we can help Sir Patrick in that. I think it's a public service thing to do, actually, to help him in this by encouraging you, look, if you are interested in the RHI inquiry, and it was one of the biggest political stories that there has been and will be in Northern Ireland for a long time, you can watch the live stream online every day. You can also go to the RHI website and read a transcript of each day's evidence. at allthews.rhiinquiry.org. There's just, Sam, I'm hesitant about saying this because I'm going to sound really weird, but I've been, any more weird than usual, by the way, but I've been watching this inquiry from the very, very beginning because I'm really interested in it. And there's just something fascinating about Sir Patrick. I don't know. I want to meet the man. Have you met him?
No.
I want to meet him. I want to be him when I grow up. Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed. Good morning to you.